listener production.
A warning. This episode contains graphic descriptions of child sexual abuse. If this content affects you, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a detective who uncovered the horrific offending of a fellow Queensland police officer. Brett Lee is a 22-year veteran of the Queensland Police Force, 16 of those spent as a detective in the field of child exploitation. We'll hear about a number of intense operations, but to start, we're going back to a case that rocked Brett and much of the force. An officer he worked with as a constable has just been flagged as a potential sex offender, and Brett is now tasked with leading the investigation.
Unbeknownst to me, when I was a young uniformed police officer at a small regional office, I worked with this guy for a few shifts. And I never thought about it at the time, but many years later, I always remembered some of the conversations he was having. He was having conversations of talking about a perverse sexual nature in relation to him and other people. And I later thought, that was really strange what he was talking about. And unbeknownst to me, when I would go home after the shift, he was going and executing an incredibly sophisticated and ongoing criminal ruse against people who were in his life, who were part of a very, very fundamental Christian organisation. So for a period of 20 years, he was committing this ruse against members, primarily of his family, but also part of this fundamental Christian organisation that he was part of as well.
He was a police officer throughout that whole time, that 20 years, while he was also involved within that Christian organisation.
Absolutely, went totally undetected. What he was doing, he was preying upon the naivety and the innocence of people who were part of this Christian organisation. He was perpetrating ruses whereby he made the victims believe that he was part of a secret undercover organisation that was established to shut down pedophile rings. There was another one where he instructed young people, I can say under 18 years of age, to get naked, and he photographed them. Now, the interesting thing about this case is that it was all based around his sexual perversion and control. He never touched a victim himself. He just instructed them to do these bizarre acts, not only the instructions to help him catch the pedophiles, but also bizarre sexual acts. That would have to be one of the strangest cases that I have ever been involved with.
Just to backtrack on that, Brett, the information that you got to start this investigation, it came from his wife, who obviously at some point discovered that there was some things going on, which then leads in your role to start to investigate this individual. How does that unfold? Like, what are the dynamics of you working in Crime Misconduct Commission, receiving that information, and then putting in place an investigation which ends up with you gathering the information? How does that unfold?
We gathered all the different people who may have been connected, other parishioners, other witnesses or potential victims. And then we just started interviewing and getting statements from everyone that was involved. We started photographing potential crime scenes. we started getting a list of all the exhibits together and the exhibits that we wanted to find. So that's how the investigation sort of started, by gathering evidence from witnesses.
When you're investigating these crimes, these offences, you're interviewing these people, is this individual, this offender, this police officer, is he still actively involved in carrying out this behaviour and conduct, or is it something that had happened in the past and finished, or was it still ongoing as you were investigating it?
As soon as the investigation started, of course, superior officers are notified, particularly because a police officer's involved. He was suspended pending the investigation, so he knew the investigation was going. Yeah, so he was suspended from active duty. Of course, he's a threat, he's a risk, potentially, at that stage. So he was suspended while the investigation was being conducted.
And I would imagine that anybody that has within him the capacity to have this sort of control over those folks, those parishioners, members of that church, to have those women do the things that they did, he would have also exercised a fair bit of control over those that you were wanting to speak to and interview. So there would have been a little bit of a cone of silence that fell upon many of those folks, I'd imagine. They, you know, similar to investigations into, be it the Catholic Church or any others, this is sort of a, there's a lot of sort of shielding information from police investigation, isn't there?
The nature of the offences are, for, I can understand, for a lot of people would be embarrassing. But as soon as the church became aware of this, he was excommunicated from the church. And of course, he was instructed not to contact anybody. And we found that people were, they were quite open. I think they felt relieved that finally someone, they all sort of were carrying the burden themselves. And I think that finally it was being looked into, that something was being done about it. So, of course, during that period, we executed a search warrant on his house as well, looking for evidence. We found so many things that were mentioned by witnesses in his home. It was very hard to balance it. Protecting the health and well-being of witnesses, gathering the evidence, making sure it's going to be admissible in a court of law, making sure that obviously he doesn't interfere with potential witnesses or complainants. So it was quite a delicate balance, but I think that this was being conducted through the Crime and Misconduct Commission. So they do have extra powers. Senior officers there had a direct involvement in this case. The detective inspector, who was, if I can say, my partner in this, she addressed the board of the church that he was involved in, and she was the first female to ever have addressed the board of that church, ever. So they were very fundamental, and it was very male-driven, and I think that's why he had a fair bit of control over particularly females from that church. These were people who were very naive. But in summing up, one of the, I don't know whether it was the prosecutor or the judge, said you preyed upon people who have a right to, you know, be innocent, to live their lives without hurting anybody else. You've taken advantage of that. You've abused that trust.
Interesting also the connection between yourself and this individual. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of police in the Queensland Police. For you to be investigating somebody that not only did you have a connection with, may have worked alongside on section or something such as that, but always had that strange sort of feeling about this bloke that things weren't quite right. You know, was what he was saying just bravado? Was there more to it? And here we are, everything's sort of gone full circle, and you're heading up an investigation against him.
You know, Brent, it's funny you say that. I never liked him. It's easy for me to say that now, but I never liked him. Now, no dispersions on police who work in traffic branch, but he was very drawn to traffic branch, and he was someone who was not very personable with people. And he would intentionally try and rile people up to have that control, to stand over people. And a lot of the police I worked with, they didn't like him either. And he didn't have many friends. So it all started to fall into place. But you're right, how, you know, there's a lot of police, a lot of water goes under the bridge. I mean, how ironic that, you know, I spent a couple of shifts as a young constable. I really don't believe he remembered me. I don't think he even knew who I was when we executed the search warrant and ended up arresting him. But yeah, how that, you're right, it just came back full circle. And it was ironic, yeah.
The Crime Misconduct Commission, is that purely investigating criminal misconduct of serving officers of police, or is it a broader scope?
No, look, what it is now, it's the Crime and Misconduct Commission. So there's two arms to it. One is crime, and they investigate organised and serious crime and the paedophilia. The other arm is misconduct, which investigates, to my best knowledge, because I didn't work in that arm, they investigate police, but also government departments as well. So it's government officers that they investigate.
Was this the first time, and perhaps the one and only time, Brett, that you were investigating what I guess is clearly a fellow officer, even though he's not one that you warmed to or had a connection with? Was this the first time you found yourself investigating a police officer?
Absolutely. And when the complaint was initially made, I was in the process of coming from the Child and Sexual Assault Unit. So that's where it was initially made. And, you know, at first, I'm glad you asked that question, because at first it really started to make me think, this is a fellow police officer. I have never done this before. And sometimes there can be this underlying code that, you know, you look after your own. So I did think about that. As soon as I started talking to those complainants, I thought, well, this is someone that shouldn't have my sympathy. This is someone that shouldn't have my protection. They're making the job harder for everybody else, you know, eroding away trust that law enforcement works very hard to keep and expand on. So, you know what, after I got into it, I had no problems whatsoever. How it was perceived by others, I really don't care.
So he was obviously prosecuted criminally, went to court. You mentioned earlier about the judge's summations. Can I ask, and do you recall, there would have been a range of charges, multiple offences. What was the final, did he do a custodial sentence? What sort of happened in the end of that?
Yeah, I mean, he was charged with, as you said, a range of offences, and it wasn't only me that decided which ones I'd charge him with. It was, you know, we had legal officers as well. And, you know, offences like false pretences, assault, bodily harm, misappropriation, aggravated assault, fraud. So a whole range of different offences that some of them normally don't go together. But he faced all of them. And yes, he's faced a custodial sentence. The thing is, he didn't plead guilty to any of it. He pleaded not guilty. He took it all the way and made all those witnesses testify. And I think that's why he got a bit longer than he would have got had he just said, you know, it was me, and pleaded guilty.
Brett, I can take you to, if I could, around 2005 or thereabouts. You're working in the area of child sex crimes, child exploitation. When you virtually took on the role of a 12-year-old boy, can you discuss that case with us and your involvement in it?
Yeah, well, my primary function in that unit was to create fictitious identities or fake identities of Australian children, of course not real children. And then to go out on the internet, not go and hunt people down, but to go where young people would go online and behave like a young person. Then it was my role to identify people who I may have thought could be a threat to children. They were there for the wrong reasons. They were looking to abuse children. So that was my job. And then it was to glean evidence when I communicated with that person that may have constituted a criminal offence. We then obviously, you know, locate that person and they would be arrested. That's the short story. So I did that for thousands and thousands of hours, and I arrested many, many online predators, and they were all slightly different. There were the ones who were looking for children, but also the opportunists. So people who weren't so much looking to harm a child, but if they were presented with the child online, that they would act on that, whether it was virtual online or whether it was a combination of online and then want to meet in the physical world. And I think most of your listeners would have heard where police go on the internet, they pretend to be kids and, you know, they catch child predators on the internet. So that was my job in essence. What we hadn't done, because we observed, and it is statistics, the vast majority of young people who get sexually abused are females. The biggest majority of offenders are males. So quite often that's what we would focus on. But on this one occasion, I assumed the identity of a 12-year-old boy who lived on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. Totally fictional. I was online as that 12-year-old boy, that persona, and I was playing a game on the internet. And I was approached by a 15-year-old young man online who started playing the game and communicating with me. He introduced me online to an adult who was a friend of his, and it was an adult man, and he said, "I'm an adult man." He disclosed that. A lot of predators, of course, assume to be children themselves. And then he started communicating, and this went on for a period of a couple of weeks. I call this type of predator the slow, patient groomer. There's speedy predators, but this guy was a slow, patient groomer. And what he started to do was to desensitize me to sexuality and to things of a sexual nature. And he did this through a 15-year-old identity online, which we always believe, and we still do, we couldn't prove this, was him pretending to be the 15-year-old to give himself credibility there and then introduce us to his real self. Now, I sort of worked out through my experience, the only reason that this adult man would want me to know that he's an adult man and that's who he is because his ultimate goal was to meet me physically, face to face in the physical world. Otherwise, he would have just pretended to be a young person himself. So he started talking to me about things of a sexual nature in relation to homosexuality. He started off by, after a couple of weeks, he started to distribute images showing adult men engaged in sexual acts. It then progressed to exposing me to images of adult men with sexual activity in relation to children, child abuse. After a while, we got all the information we need. We knew exactly who he was. But what he'd done, he wanted to arrange a meeting. He said he was prepared to fly up to Queensland. And this is going over a period of weeks where he has slowly chipped away to desensitize what he believed was a child. He did it very slowly and very methodically and very believably. So he arranged to come up to Queensland. He was going to meet me. We then discovered that he may have had access to children. As you've probably worked out, he was in another state. So we decided to close the operation down and remove him from the public. So we got all our paperwork together, which was quite extensive because we were crossing our jurisdiction, Queensland, into another jurisdiction, New South Wales. So we travelled down to New South Wales. We worked with the local police, the CIB, Criminal Investigation Branch, and we went to his workplace and he was arrested. We executed search warrants on his house, got all of his devices, and we found multiple evidence on his devices that established he was the person I was talking to. So the reason we wanted to close that quick is he then started to indicate he had access to actual children. So we couldn't let that continue. Why this case was interesting, it was the first one, certainly for our office, and it was the first one that I know of. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's the first one I know of where we extradited somebody from another state to Queensland to face these charges. Now, what's interesting about that is that he didn't come into Queensland to commit those offences, but he used the telecommunication lines, the internet, to come into Queensland. So it was one of the first ones. And when we went to court in New South Wales first, I don't think the magistrate and even the prosecutor really understood where they were standing in relation to this. This was quite a while ago. The laws have really evolved in that law enforcement is starting to appreciate the nature of technology. I mean, before technology came along, law enforcement, you would know, Brent, Nelly, better than me, that, you know, it was very jurisdictional. You know, if I wanted as a Queensland police officer to go to New South Wales, I'm not licensed to carry a gun there, so I can't even really go across the border. If I want to bring somebody back to Queensland, there's the commissioner from Queensland's really got to sign off, and the commissioner from New South Wales has got to say, hey, yeah, that's okay. Now let's go to a court and see if they'll send that person back. So it was a huge, huge process. I believe it's getting a lot more streamlined now, because technology has changed the goalposts. So we've got to change our thinking a bit. And there's a lot more coordination in relation to particularly offences where, I mean, if you can imagine someone sitting in Victoria sends child exploitation material to a child in Queensland. I mean, you've just gone across two totally different jurisdictions, state jurisdictions. So it is a lot more streamlined now. It's a lot easier for police that I believe. Look, I haven't done the job for 16 years. But from talking to people and still being sort of on the fringes involved with what's happening, it's a lot more streamlined. But back then, you know, when we had this investigation, I believe it was one of the first, and people were really struggling to find out, how do we deal with this information in a legal sense?
Brett, it's so interesting you say this, because like you say, early 2000s, it was early days with regards to police doing what we would call now like an undercover role virtually. You were going undercover as a 12-year-old boy, which is, it's quite a bizarre concept at the time, because we were chatting about an ex-colleague of yours, a gentleman I had the privilege of interviewing last year, John Rouse. John Rouse was very much a pathfinder for a lot of this, and he spoke about not only interstate jurisdictional, you know, barriers in those early days, like you say, like, well, this guy was in New South Wales, but he was contacting what he thought to be a child in Queensland. Where was the offence committed, New South Wales or Queensland? But of course, then as we go further into this realm of online grooming and one thing and another, as John said, and Brett, you would be well aware, we start to go internationally as well. It took quite some time, didn't it, for not only state to state in Australia to come to terms with this, but also international jurisdictions to go, okay, we need to work together on this, not sort of put these barriers up, because it was actually enabling a lot of this stuff to go on, and everyone was sort of looking at each other's, okay, how do we deal with this? Because, you know, we talk about it now in 2024, but we're going back over 20 years and all this was very, very new, wasn't it?
Look, the internet had been around for a little while, but when it came to, you know, free programs that enable people to connect and share a lot of information, and it became very user-friendly. So it's when all these programs started to emerge, and some of the first ones that, you know, the ones we were working with, and we forget about them, like MySpace, MSN Messenger, social media and instant messaging programs. That's when it exploded. And I mean, internationally, laws can differ dramatically. But you also may deal with countries internationally that may not possess the same values that our country does. And they don't investigate that at all. And, you know, criminals have a free rein. So that was a huge, huge, I think we're going to look back and say that was a big milestone when it came to policing in a global sense. And sort of that's the mindset we have to have. This is a global issue. So law and order moves very slowly because it has to be right. To change anything takes a while. So people can understand and what is needed. I mean, sending an image that's an illegal image from Canada to Australia. I mean, to get the evidence from Australia back to Canada, how are you going to do that? Because, you know, it's a consideration that I'm distributing child exploitation material, even though it's for a good purpose. So, yeah, there's all those considerations. And that the guest you had on, John Rouse, he's probably best positioned of anybody in the world to explain that at length and, you know, where we've come in that period of time, of which he was a big part.
You received some training through the FBI with regards to working in these roles. Is that correct?
Yes, Brent. Look, I consider myself very fortunate. I had an opportunity to work over there with the FBI, and most of it was training for me. So I did the advanced undercover internet course. I attended their conferences. And, we learned different strategies. Of course, one of the things that always used to get thrown up, oh, this is entrapment. And of course, that's frowned upon, called agent provocateur, of course. meaning agent provocateur or entrapment is when you create an offence that wouldn't have existed had you not created it. But that's not what we were doing. And we had to be very careful with the questions that we asked and how we went about the investigations. Everything was screen recorded and it had to be admissible. So we only ever presented ourselves as a normal child. We didn't create offences, and the FBI sort of ran us through all that. And you know, that was very, very beneficial. And I, you know what I would say the most interesting part of these investigations was? Before I started doing the undercover investigations, a complainant would come to us, like the last case, and they'd say, look, this has happened. And we'd investigate it from there. When I was actually pretending to be the child online, I was there when the offence was being committed. So I could see the inner workings of child sex offenders' minds. I was there when they were going through all their tactics and their methodologies. I could see what they were asking. I could see the actual level of depravity that goes on in the minds of the small minority of people from our community. So that was the most interesting part of these investigations, that I was there when the offence was being committed, which I'd never experienced before.
That's a really interesting connection that you make, Brett, because all of the work, or a lot of the work that you do as a police officer, is looking at an offence retrospectively from the outside in, gathering evidence from the past, putting it in the present, presenting it in court to get a conviction. Here, your positioning is totally different. You're within the crime. The crime is technically being committed against you as a virtual child. And that's, like you say, that's a really interesting way to look at it. And I guess one that respectfully, some police would possibly have some difficulty and trouble with dealing with that.
Look, yeah, I had a conversation recently in relation to this. I feel that, you know, the reason police do it, obviously, is to identify and remove offenders before they have a chance to do it to a real child. That's the purpose of it. For a lot of police, it wasn't their type of investigation. Some did it and couldn't handle it. I don't feel it affected me in such a negative way. I feel that I could distance myself from it quite easily. Probably one of the things that helped was my particular role was not actually dealing with real child victims when I was doing this job. I was the victim. So I didn't have to empathise with an actual victim. I just had to focus on the offender. But certainly there's police who don't understand the investigation. They don't like doing this sort of investigation, or it affects them in a deeply personal way, you know, in a psychological way. And I really understand that, because, of course, part of doing this job is you're exposed to some very concerning content on the internet and concerning behaviour. I put a few of my cases, I wrote them down into a book. There were cases I couldn't put in the book because I didn't think it was in the public interest. It was just too gratuitous. But I don't feel that that really had that negative effect on me. I found that I could distance myself easily, but everyone's got a different personality. Everyone's faced different experiences and maybe some trauma in their life. So it's a type of investigation. I think you've got to select people who are maybe set up to do it.
Interesting, Brett, you say that, and you say it in a very humble way, that although you worked in this environment for quite some period of time, And as you've so honestly said, you know, you're placing yourself in the path of these predators, these pedophiles. You're also working in these environments, having to look at thousands and thousands of images of child exploitation. And I've had the privilege of having many on the other side of the microphone who've worked in those roles, often for many, many years, who speak very openly about how they're trucking along, and then all of a sudden it just became too much. And many, many police who work in those roles, it can cause terrible, terrible ongoing post-traumatic stress and that type of thing. I'm interested, did you have to work on that? Did you have a way of compartmentalizing this work and being able to sort of separate it? I know John Rouse, as we've spoken about, very kindly said his escape was music. He's a musician himself, and he would do that. He would have things outside, I think, running. And you know, I've spoken to other officers that would swim miles and miles every morning just to sort of like almost cleanse themselves and wash this stuff out. I'm interested, Brett, during that time of working in this environment, did you have anything that you did that you helped assist you in this process?
Look, I can't say I can focus on something specifically, but look, maybe I came from a generation where you just box on. I don't know. And John would have come from that as well. Like John, I'm a musician, so I use that now, particularly to escape. But I don't think I did have anything in particular that I used, even though I did have to view them. Because if you're going to charge someone with possession of child abuse material, someone has to look at it. You have to see it to say that that's what it is. So someone had to look at it. There's those who looked at a lot more than I did. I can't think of something that I particularly focused on during that time. I had my friends, I had my social life, I travelled, I had my family. So I had my own kids as well. So I had those things in my life, I think, to focus on. But when it comes to something specific, I don't think I did. Maybe I should have. I don't know.
So, Brett, having joined the job back in 85, 22 years down the track takes us to 2007. And for you, you felt that was it. You're done with the job. You'd had a lot of experiences, good, bad, and indifferent, as anybody in any job after 22 years. I'm interested, Brett, in that transition from policing, because you had some interesting roles after that. Also what you're doing now and maybe touching on some of the motivation that you've spoken of with regards to writing those couple of books about some of those policing experiences you'd had. But you left the job and did a bit of time in Iraq, I think, training police there.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, one of the most common questions I get asked is, oh, you left the job because you'd had enough. And I said, no, I love the job. I love my mates. But working, as we discussed earlier, working with the FBI and other agencies, I thought, you know what, I want to expand a bit, that there's got to be more out there. So the opportunity came up in 2007 through a former police colleague to travel to Iraq and work at the Iraq Police Academy at a place called Anumnya. It was training Iraqi men how to be police. So it was a police academy. It would have been the first civilian police force Iraq would have had, because it was paramilitary before that time. And over there in 8 months, I like to tell people, I cleared my head when I was in Iraq, and I knew what path I wanted to take. Because when I was in the police doing the undercover internet stuff, our inspector said, look, I've got a friend who works at a school, and some of the girls are talking about things that are happening online, and the school's getting quite concerned. And this was back in the early 2000s. They said, can you go and talk to the girls? So me and my partner went out, and we spoke at a girls' school in Brisbane. It was to year 10 girls. And I was just flabbergasted by the naivety of these girls as it related to what was going on online. And it was then I sort of thought, do you know what? Education's needed. These girls are end users. They need to know the world they're in. And not much was being done anywhere in Australia in relation to the education of the end user, whether it be adults or kids. So when I went to Iraq, I, you know, sort of hatched a plan that when I got back, I'd start a business and go into schools and educate, use the experience I had, my very unique look on technology, you know, the different face of technology I'd seen, to highlight dangers and responsibilities, and then give them some strategies to avoid those dangers, because I thought that's honestly the key. So when I got back, I just contacted some schools in Brisbane, and a couple of schools said, yep, love it, come in. And that's where it all started, back in 2008. In May of 2008, I did my first cyber safety presentation out of school in Brisbane, Corinda State High School, I can say. And it just went from there, and it just exploded. I think I picked an industry that was growing, cyber safety. So it's changed over the years, but for the last 16 years then and now, that's all we do. We educate children, teachers, parents. We do face-to-face. We got online courses, and we support communities and families as best we can. So there's a number of different people who go out and speak for me, all got very credible backgrounds and are very well positioned to pass the messages on, particularly to young people. And look, I think it's everyone's dream at some stage. You talk to most people and they say, on my bucket list, I want to write a book. So I partnered with a childhood friend of mine who's a journalist, a very good man. And we wrote a book that included some of my undercover internet investigations and some of the other investigations that I did. But a lot of it contains protective strategies. A lot of it's awareness for parents. So it's written for the community to help support young people. And that's what it's about. And the book isn't there to gratuitize, you know, the dangers or the bad stuff, but it is to make people aware. I mean, we're very passionate as parents when it comes to protecting our kids in the physical world because we know the dangers. We know they're real. It's about understanding that our role is as important as it relates to our kids and technology.
Brett, I just want to thank you so very much for joining us here today. You've chatted to us via the studio up there in Brisbane. You've been so open and frank about what is, to be fair, a very dark area of investigation, of a police investigation, and you know, that area of cyber area with kids and that type of thing. But you've been so open and frank and so humble with regards to your involvement in it. Brett, I want to thank you for the, you know, your service of that 22 years to the good people of Queensland, but also perhaps as much the work that you've gone on to do and taking all that experience from that time in the police. And I hope that you continue with the work that you're doing, and it's an absolute credit to you, mate. Thanks for coming in for a chat.
Thank you.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly. If you're concerned about the thoughts and behaviour of yourself or another adult or child, there is support available. Stop It Now is an anonymous Australian helpline that aims to support adults who have sexual thoughts about children to prevent offending. The helpline is for parents, professionals, family and community members who come across child sexual abuse. If you're worried about an adult's or child's behaviour, online or offline, you can call the anonymous helpline on 1800 01 1800, or use a live chat or secure messaging service. To find out more, head to stopitnow.org.au.